Hi, this is Joe Roberts with OneWineDude.com, and you're listening to One Wine Dude Radio. Today I'm talking to Maynard James Keenan, who most of you out there are going to recognize as the frontman for the platinum-selling and Grammy-winning act Tool, but some others of you out there may recognize his name as the founder and winemaker for Caduceus Cellars in Arizona. We talk a little bit about what it's like making wine in Arizona, what's important to Maynard as a winemaker, and how he deals with crazy fans who send him paintings made from their own blood. Anyway, let's have a listen.
How are you?
Good.
Good? Hey, thanks for taking the time.
Not a problem.
What's going on right now at Caduceus? Are you busy?
I was just out on the road for a few weeks trying to pay the bills. We just pretty much put everything in barrel just before I left mid-October. We had a pretty early season. This year was very strange. Pretty much all of our Arizona stronghold, or all of our Arizona fruit, both northern and southern Arizona, was in and processed. I think it's like beginning of October, really, and then everything was down to barrel by October 15th. And I went out the door to go rehearse for the Perfect Circle tour, which is it's a good feeling knowing that all that timing lined up. I can't remember what day I actually came to LA, but I think it was the 15th I came to LA, but the 14th. I was finishing up something, didn't quite finish it. In the morning of the 15th, I was actually racking some wine from bin to barrel. Stuck the bung in the hole and on my merry way.
Yeah, right on. It's interesting. I a couple questions I got from people, and I got actually a lot of questions from readers and things to pass on. But one of the questions was, is wine actually your primary gig now? So is the band stuff, the rock stuff, and the touring work, is that working around the schedule for the winery?
I would have to say that whatever I'm doing at the moment is my primary mission. So everything gets my full attention once I've changed hats. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
But the one thing that is that demands more of a scheduling is the wine, because I can't make the grapes be ripe in July.
Right on, yeah.
So as far as harvest, touring has to work around harvest and even racking and bottling and all that in the winery can be adjusted left or right accordingly. But the harvest, that's pretty much cut and dry. That is what it is.
And you've got at least three fairly major music acts that you're performing with. When you sort of gave the news to these guys and your bandmates and these projects that you were kind of jumping headfirst in the wine world, did you have to convince them that you're still sane? Yeah,
I guess that, I'm sure as time goes on, it's starting to sink in. I'm not sure if you're familiar with a lot of musicians and the way their worlds work, but it's very insular.
Yeah. I am. I've played music for about 20 plus years, so obviously not.
The worst thing that can happen to you is success, because then it becomes even more of a terrarium, like a closed system, and you're not really aware of how people actually behave in the world. You're very insulated, and to be honest, a lot of those artists haven't got the faintest idea how to actually start and run a business or come up with a business plan and stick to the budgets and. They have no idea any of that stuff, so they just get to be the child king, pointing and growling. when you go off to actually do something that requires, focus and discipline, and you're kind of a slave to the weather. Of course, they just don't even understand. They don't understand why you're not doing blow in Belgium with them.
Right. Do you think
I'm an adult? I don't know.
Yeah. Do you think that the wine industry has similar trappings in terms of the insular aspect? I mean, I just from personal experience, working with a lot of people in California and producers, I find myself telling them, well, you got interesting, big, luscious wine here. And they said, no, it's not luscious, because they're comparing it to the guy down the road who makes, super Enormo cab, and theirs happens to be a little less Enormo. And I think there's a lot of like California goggles and other types of things going on. Have you encountered that at all in your interviewing?
Absolutely. I definitely can see that. Generally, and it's all site specific, but generally speaking, now looking at what we're getting out of the vineyards in Arizona, both northern and southern, we're getting some fruit that's just, crazy color and huge, just huge fruit bomb on some in some of the blocks, like some of the Norte Syrah that we're getting out of southern Arizona has some of that big jammy character. But generally speaking, we're getting a lot more minerality, a lot more restraint to the fruit. In some cases, it's not necessarily a lot of color. In some cases, yes, but not in a lot of cases, no. But which is, and sometimes very specific to the varietal. Like trying to get color out of Nebbiolo or Barbera is always a challenge. But we're finding that even on some of the Sangioveses and cabs, we're not. I couldn't make a Paso Robles Syrah if I tried, just because something about that soil is it just does that. Big fruit bomb cabs. So I'm finding that as far as our insular situation, my palate's now completely changed. I appreciate more Italian style wines, old world European wines, because they're in general more restrained like that. They're easier to eat with meals, easier to drink alone. And I can't do the fruit bombs from California.
Yeah, I should congratulate you on the Tempranillo, by the way, because thanks for making a Tempranillo that doesn't taste like the wood that it was aged in for 1,000 months.
Yeah, and to be honest, I probably shouldn't even have released that wine yet. It's still, to me, is still super tight, super
Yeah.
restrained. It needs to be, that one I think needed to be in bottle a little longer, or at the very least, like in some neutral oak for a while, just to kind of age it up a little bit.
But it's still pretty good. I mean, I guess I'm kind of talking to Rioja here, with that comment. But I mean, some of these Riojas, some of these Grand Reservas I've tried are, I mean, it's just like a smack of wood in the head. And it was really nice to taste the Tempranillo that doesn't taste like that.
Yeah, and I don't know if if it was on the in literature or anything. Did you get the 08 Sancha?
I believe so.
The 08 Sancha has a splash of Grenache in it, just a little bit, along with the Tempranillo.
Yeah, it
Just
was the
because I felt,
08.
yeah, the 08. So it was. There's just a splash of Grenache in there, and that was. I kind of tossed that in there just to lighten up that. Some of that attack that was on the Tempranillo, because we are getting a nice taut Tempranillo off that block. And I've noticed that if I take the 07 and I open it up and pour like just a half a glass out of it, and then just put the cork back in and revisit it 5 days later, it starts to turn into a really luscious Reserve Rioja. But it takes 5 days of it being exposed to oxygen to kind of get it there, which
Yeah.
tells me that it definitely needs some aging time. And I kind of put that Grenache in there just to kind of soften it up a little bit, make it a little more approachable, give it a little bit more of that fruit character, ripe fruit, approachable stuff.
Yeah, and it seems like you're a fan of the blend, in terms of your approach to the wine. And I did get a couple questions from readers actually, and one of them was about blending, and one of them was pretty interesting. So do you is the way you look at blending, is it like a long-term commitment of different grapes in the barrel and fermenting, or, and this is a quote, is it a blind date where they meet and greet in the bottle hoping for love at first mix?
A lot of it is just my inexperience, partly of course my inexperience with winemaking and me responding to what I'm tasting in the glass, not really having any kind of history or a database to refer to from my own experiences prior of what happens with this particular block of fruit down the road. So I'm trying to keep a leash on that a little bit. So I am trying to bottle some stuff that's pure varietal from specific blocks. But I'm also tasting within the glass and trying to figure out, okay, you know, my Tetris mind at work, what's missing from this experience in my mouth and the nose on this and the finish, and how does it go with food? If I'm having a roasted chicken or if I'm having some vegetable pasta, like what's missing from this wine that would make it go better with these kind of dining experiences? And I think the restraint comes from that, and just filling in the holes is why I would go with some blends.
Interesting. It brings up an interesting question in my mind, actually, about when you're blending and when you're setting out to make your wines. And I've always wanted to pose this question to a winemaker, but I never thought they'd understand it, because it's a music context, and you're probably uniquely suited to understand this. You know, when I've recorded bass tracks for albums that I've done with guys I'm working with, you know, I've had moments where the inspiration for what I want to do comes in strange ways. So I may set out on a track to say, I think I'm going to go for like late 80s Geddy Lee on this or something, and what comes out is like the Smiths or something totally different in the context of what we're doing. And I wondered if the winemakers get into that space where you've got something in mind when you start out with the wine, and you end up totally different from what you had intended, and you realize later on that it was because of the influence of some other style or some other region or whatever that kind of wormed its way into your brain and your heart. I mean, do you ever find that going on with the wines you're trying now?
In the first year of making wine with having to use California fruit, because our Arizona fruit wasn't ready yet, that first year in 2004 of making wine, of course, the first thing I did was pull out a bunch of bottles and say, this is the kind of similar wines that I am into now. But, you know, with the disclaimer of, I have no idea what we're going to get off of our Arizona blocks, but if I had to choose now to just be able to, like, cherry pick some grapes from around the country to make some wine, these are the wines that I like, and then let's see if we can't make something like this. So sourced some fruit from California, figured out what those were, and I think they ended up being, you know, as of an education, because you can't make wine from some other region from another region's grapes. It's just not going to, you can try, but you're going to end up having to go, well, this is what this piece of soil produces, and if this is what you're going to do, then you immediately kind of snap into, let the song become what it's going to be. Don't worry about whether it sounds like Geddy Lee or the Smiths. Just kind of let it tell you where it wants to go. If that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. One question that came up with some readers, and it popped up in my mind too, and it's kind of like the elephant in the room, and I've heard you don't like discussing the rock star thing, but to me, not touching on that at least a little bit seems kind of fake, and I can't be fake. And I guess what I'm wondering most is, how much does the fame, does that interfere with or complicate what you're doing in the wine world? I mean, do you ever turn away like crazy fucked up fans from the tasting room, or?
You know, we do have that issue. I think that there's some younger people who aren't quite, once again, they're so used to watching clowns on stage be clowns, and they emulate that behavior, and they think that that's how those clowns want them to behave. I've never really been that guy, but of course there's an army of other bands that, you know, throw pianos out hotel windows and stuff and behave in that way. I've just never been that guy, but generally speaking, 90% of what they see are, you know, brats throwing a tantrum, extreme behavior, not very social, not very community-oriented, not very family-oriented behavior.
Right.
So, you know, they sometimes come, but that's, generally speaking, that's very That's not the case always. There's a few handfuls of those behaviors. And, you know, of course, the obsessive, you know, send you paintings and with their own blood, like weird. Like, yeah, okay, just.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I can't even respond to you. You just, not part.
I wouldn't even know where to start with that. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think in general, we're just as a nation, you've probably seen a renaissance in the last 10 years. I would go out on a limb and say, you know, Nirvana, you know, took away the hairband situation, the infestation. They helped kind of usher us into a new era of music. And I think that as far as our understanding of wine and cuisine and just our senses in general of understanding fresh produce and why that would make a better meal, the Food Network. The Food Network has just helped people. It's almost like a gateway drug. Now they start to understand food pairings and just why wine is important, why this wine is better. So I think people that recognize something different in the music that I've done and responded to that recognize that there's also something now in their lives. They're starting to recognize, you know, better foods, locally grown, you know, just all those things that go into a person becoming more conscious as an individual. So although the music thing might have been a negative at first as far as who was coming up and for what reason, I think just in their lives individually, where they were based on when I started making music and where they are now as fans, I think it's almost like a perfect time for them to, they're not really concerned so much about who I am specifically and what I've done. They're more excited about who they are now and what they're discovering.
And growing into the experience
right.
in a way with you guys. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, just, but, you know, speaking from just an economic environment right now, use what you got, you know, it's a tough world out there in every world. I'm sure just trying to get traffic to your website isn't the easiest task, you know, just trying to have a presence. People, you have to rely on people, you know, pretty much finding you and you delivering, and then they stay around. Once they respect your opinions on wine and they respect the people that come to your site and also comment on what you've commented on, you have a viable site, but it's a very viral thing. And whatever people would say about dismissing what I'm doing because it's just a rock star thing, they just think it's kind of a Vince Neil thing or something. There's going to be a handful of people that get it and know that it's not that. And that's fine. That's what I'm going for. Not trying to take over the world, just trying to do what I'm doing and just, you know, hopefully find an audience that appreciates it.
And interesting, couple things that actually kicks off in my mind. Yeah, I remember at the end of A Blood Into Wine, one of the things that really stuck with me in that film was there's a bit at the end where you say you're hoping that the story of what you guys are trying to do in Arizona would influence other people to go after kind of their dreams, right? And have you guys gotten stories about people being influenced by what you're doing?
I think so. I got a couple people that have gone on to do some pretty cool stuff. Nothing specific, just which I think is actually better in a way that somebody just kind of drops an email. Like, then I guess there's a fine line between writing and saying you are solely responsible for my salvation, which I don't even respond to. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. And the passing email that goes, hey man, you're right. And I kind of started doing a thing on my own, and thanks. And that's it. That's better to me. I love that. When somebody just in passing says, hey, thanks for the nudge. It's still up
right.
to you. It's still you have to go do a thing. And if you get to the point where, like, it's just enough, it's, you know, I was part of the catalyst, and you kind of just reach out and go, hey, thanks, and move on. But to make it so that this one individual is solely responsible for your awakening, that's just a lot of fucking responsibility.
It's almost like an abdication in a way. I think people look to do...
Giving your power. I didn't. You have your own power. Stop giving your power to me. Hang on to
yeah.
it.
Yeah. It's almost like I find that a lot in some of the wineries trying to chase after scores. It's almost like they're abdicating the responsibility of making something unique to making something that will get a high score and sell.
Absolutely. When you start giving away your power to those people who are judging, then you're now at their mercy forever. You keep giving them that power. Same thing with, you know, large radio stations in the major cities. If you want to be successful, and the way you got successful was by, like, using that radio station to get on the map, well, naturally, you didn't use them, they used you. And now you are beholden to them, because if you don't give them what they want for their big festivals that they put on, or, you know, some kind of free ticket giveaways and this promotion, they just won't promote you, and now you're fucked.
Right. You know, speaking of the scores, I like to ask winemakers about what they think of scores, and usually it comes in the phrase of something like, "Are there any wine critics you'd like to kick in the crotch?" You know, or something like that. But you know, I remember in Blood and the Wine, another thing that jumped out at me was that your take on wine reviews and scores seem really diplomatic and pretty balanced, and you were definitely coming at it from a consumer standpoint, right? Of like what you like to drink versus the scores. But now that you're making wine, right? Has that changed?
No, I think it's the same. I think it's interesting. Some of my best-selling wines are the ones that, depending on the forum, depending on the judge, they don't necessarily get good scores under one competition, and all of a sudden they get good scores under another. There seems to be a disconnect between, you know, our you know, always any winemaker's presentation, of course, and I'm just, you know, repeating here. I'm just a parrot. Just, you know, enjoy what's in the glass. Just taste what's in the glass. If you like what's in the glass, then take home what's in the glass. And that's kind of a philosophy, I think, of most tasting rooms that are being honest about their process. That the ones that aren't, I guess, to qualify, the ones that aren't chasing the scores are doing that.
Right.
And generally speaking, the wines that people walk out the door with are not necessarily the ones that are getting consistent scores in those settings, in those tasting rooms. Because people, if you just let people decide for themselves, they're probably not going to decide on what the magazine said or the blog said. They're going to have their own experience and take home, and it's pretty consistent, generally speaking. The Premier Passo was one of the wines we do. It's a Syrah Malvasia blend, and it's hard for judges to deal with that wine because it doesn't fall into any category that they can figure out how to navigate. So some people just don't get it and they just give it awful scores, and others just love it because it's so new and fresh and unique, and it doesn't, you know, fall in line with what they're used to scoring, so it stands out. So doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to it. But sorry to waffle on, but to answer your question, I still don't think, I'm very curious about scores because I want to see how people react to Arizona wines, but it's not going to change the way we're making the wines, and it's not going to change the way we're doing business, and it's not going to tell me that not to like a wine that I love.
What are the wines that you love now in terms of the portfolio you're putting together? Like, what's the most fun for you making? Is it the stuff that you described that is the more eclectic blend, or?
It's the stuff, it's always nice to go into a vineyard that you're pretty confident about and pick the grapes and get them from vine to glass and go, that's as good as I expected or better than I expected, and that vineyard, just there's a site characteristic that's just very exciting, and it's unique when you compare it to other, say, other Cabernets in the area or other Sangioveses in the area. The site has this characteristic that's exciting, but almost more exciting to me is when something comes in that's subpar fruit or something that just somehow just your access to getting that fruit, it was way under the sugar level you wanted it at, or way over the sugar level you wanted it at. and then the process of saving it and making a great wine out of a challenge. When you come up with something, even if it's only an 85% or 90% good wine, that it's not a complete disaster is very inspiring.
Sort of like the underdog. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, yeah, look at this one. This one made it through against all odds. We made a wine out of this, and it tastes great. It's not superb. It's not world class. But this one, the one that was like, you know, the mutt, the runt of the litter, ended up coming out pretty damn good. Lots of personality. So I've had a lot of fun with that in the cellar, especially this year, because this is the first year that I've actually made wine completely on my own with my fiance. She runs all the numbers and does all the lab work, and I'm doing all the work in the cellar. And so this is the first year we actually did it all on our own, and I did half my production there. But of course, you know, I covered my ass. I made sure that Tim White over at Arizona Stronghold Vineyards, where I normally do all my custom crush stuff, I made sure that he had the good stuff, you know, the Judith, the Marzo, all that went there. And I kind of took the second round draft picks and took them to MySpace to see, you know, if I could do it without fucking it up.
Right. Yeah. And you're going family business on us.
Well, that's always been the goal. And even, you know, even in past years, initially when we first, you know, in 04, I was there pretty much through the whole process. And then all of a sudden you realize you spent all this money on making this wine, and you're sitting on all these cases of wine just going, oh fuck, I got to sell this. So then you're like, I would say 07, 08, like all of a sudden, like all my time that I was spending in the cellar for Crush, and then during all the other periods of time racking and barreling down stuff, I don't get to be in there anymore. Now I got to go out and like shake hands and sell this stuff, because, you know, you're sitting on several hundred cases, you know, 1,000 cases of wine. So that kind of took me away from that process, which sucks, because I, you know, the more I'm not in the trenches, the less I'm learning. So this year was great because I actually got to go back in and remember all the stuff I was doing, because you only get one chance, once a year, to remember how to do all this stuff. It's not like you can do it every month and really hone your skills. One time a year, you get your chance to remember what the hell it was you did a year ago. That's why notes are so important and that kind of just experience. So luckily, I, you know, had all those notes and did it this year. So I made on my own in the cellar. I took some chances because at this stage in my winemaking career, I can take major chances with no major repercussions, because people don't expect anything anyway. They just think I'm just a douchebag putting my name on a bottle. I can take all kinds of crazy chances. So this year, I have a very small facility. I can do, if I really, really stretch it and get my forklift skills down, I can probably do about 3,500 maybe, you know, 3,000 cases, 3,500 maybe a year. But the comfortable, easily flexible number in that cellar is going to be 2,000 cases. That's like, you know, barely double stacking barrels, just letting them be single high and walk around comfortably, take your friends through barrel taste and enough fermentation space in bins that I can do that. And when I say 2,000 cases, that's me being able to take, for example, if I have 5 tons of Cabernet coming in, I can divide up that cab into, let's just use 3 tons for example. I can divide up single ton, each ton, just distem that, put it into a bin on its own, and then ferment those in slightly different ways. And then through the whole process, keep those three bins separate every step of the way. So that by the time we barrel down, you know, I have two barrels of a particular process of each of those tons. So my cab is now three different cabs, all those from the same block. Mm-hmm. They're all going to have the same site characters. They're all going to be generally 90% where they're from, but it'll be that 10% difference that I can go, okay, now as an education, I can tell you that this process works best for me. I have the best results this way. And then you have to remember, oh, shit, until next year when it comes in, something's different. So in theory, that's what I'll continue to do. I have the elbow room enough to be able to isolate every one of those batches and do separate process to each one, whether it's, you know, pressing them off halfway through their fermentation and stick them in a barrel and, you know, barrel fermentations, or, you know, doing the same grapes in stainless steel and then some just in open top bins. All the little nuances you've heard about everywhere, mm-hmm. just to try to figure out, for me as a winemaker, that process, which one is the most comfortable for me, which one can I recognize what's going on in the grapes best, and now I'll bring in, you know, the better fruit and try it on those. I think you hear it every day of the week from, like, well, I used to like that winery, but they got too big. And that is absolutely, absolutely a valid argument. Because there's no possible way for, you know, a family-owned business to babysit wine when it gets to a certain amount. There's just no possible way. There's not enough minutes in a day to go around and touch every one of those bins.
Yeah.
To really make that what's happening is what you say is happening.
I've often wondered about that. It's funny because a couple of the... I'm heading over to Portugal next week, and one of the big things I want to do is sit a couple of these winemakers down and ask them how the hell they do that, oversee these massive operations.
Well, a lot of it ends up being that they have to hire more people.
Well, of course, yeah.
And then now you're beholden to, you know, everything that goes along with that. If you're a young touring band, every individual that you add to your tour is a huge expense, because now that guy you bring it out on the road is... That's a hotel, that's a meal every day, that's a per diem, that's a flight or a space on the bus. It's everything you got to do. If you can figure out a way to do your own fucking laundry, you just saved yourself several $1,000s.
Yep.
It's not just the cost of the laundry, it's the cost of that, all the stuff that goes along with that human. So, and the trick is to not have a lot of laundry and don't need to do that. So if you don't get too big, then you don't have to worry about it. Stay small, keep it in-house, pay attention. And you'll be better. You'll be better off.
Yeah, you're talking here a lot about gaining your knowledge from experience. And, you know, not too long ago, you know, I asked Les Claypool, kind of jokingly, right, who he thought would win in a fight between the two of you guys in terms of, you know, for the title of number one rock front man wine guy. He gave the nod to you because he said you were studying jiu-jitsu, so he figured if you got a hold of him, he was dead. But he also mentioned that he said that you have a pretty vast knowledge of wine, I think was the quote. And I was curious, would you agree with that now that you're making it, a few years into it? And, corollary to that question, where are you going now to get your wine information in terms of stuff that you're not learning hands on?
I think a lot of it is perspective, and I guess the benefit I have, I think there's some fantastic winemakers in Arizona. I think some of the guys you're going to end up hearing about, because eventually my story is going to be tired. People are just going to be like sick of hearing about it. I mean, the good news is that there's a guy in Arizona that can bring some thunder and bring some focus to what's happening in Arizona. And then the better news is that once you're done listening to my hot air, you're going to discover there's a buttload of awesome wines in Arizona. And those guys all have their own stories to tell.
Yeah, so you're dragging the spotlight over.
Yeah, just getting it in there. And those guys are all competent winemakers. They're fucking fantastic winemakers. Kent Callaghan, Todd Bostock, Keeling Schaefer. There's some great winemakers in Arizona. They just, you know, they've pretty much done what you would expect them to do, is to basically keep it small and just keep it family and sell their wines in Arizona and be happy with that. But I think there's always it's good to give it a little bit of a nudge so that there's a little bit more focus, so that people are actually going out of their way to come to Arizona to find the wines. And that's really important. But I think the leg up that I have on some of those guys is, although every now and then, you know, everybody, they're a wine drinker, so there's going to be somebody showing up with a fantastic bottle of wine that they'll have access to. But the little bit of a leg up that I have, and it's just a slightly little extra edge, and it's only relevant if I can take the experience away from you and remember what it was that I experienced. You know, if you have short and long-term memory loss, that's not going to help you. But having been to all those countries, having had a little bit of a bank account on the road to try just some sick over the top pricey wines, just having access to world-class stuff that most people can't afford to try has given me a little bit of a wider perspective on what's possible in the world. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to be able to make good wine. Guys who write wine blogs and understand stuff, the master sommeliers can't necessarily make wine. Just like music critics can't necessarily write music, although
sure.
they can tell you all about it and they remember every B-side the Beatles ever did. Doesn't mean they're going to be able to write a song.
Right.
So that experience of having access to that fruit doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to make better wine, but it does. It does if I can take the experience with me and recognize in my soil what its, not only what its strengths are, but what are its weaknesses, and embrace them and figure out a way to work with those weaknesses and strengths.
Speaking of the expensive juice, one reader contacted me and said, ask Maynard when he's going to drink that expensive bottle of Grange that he bought a few years ago.
Probably never. because that's a museum piece. Honestly, that's not really something you would crack open unless you see multiple mushroom clouds and it's time to. I won't even make it to that one. There's a bunch of bottles in line ahead of that one.
So what's next for you guys at Caduceus? What do you got in the horizon?
I had to pop over to L.A. unfortunately, to do a few things. I was involved in the guys who directed Blood Into Wine just did a film called Queens of Country with Lizzie Kaplan and Ron Livingston, Joe Latrullio, and Matt Walsh. And I have a small part in that film. And, of course, I have to come to L.A. because that overdubbing, what they call ADR.
Right,
I'm going to do some overdubbing. So while I'm here, I'm going to work on some Pulitzer music, work on some APC music, and do that overdubbing, and then head back to AZ. So the next thing I have to do in the cellar is to not do anything. I have to go into the cellar, look at the barrels, and force myself not to do anything, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Don't touch it. Don't fuck with it. Just
don't
like
mess
let
it right.
be.
Right.
Yeah. There are things I have to test. There's some numbers I have to run. Some of the barrels are still going through ML. I just got to get them through that so I can SO2 them and get them in the back room and put them to bed. Some of the barrels, we're topping them off while they're sitting in their little suspended state. And I think the next thing that I have to do is, of course, and it's all timing, like if I have to go out and make the extra money to make this thing keep working, I had to time it. I had to go, okay, so am I gonna rack? If I'm going to rack, am I going to rack in early January or am I going to rack in late February? Because that's my window now. I've had to adjust that schedule around a touring schedule. So that's the next thing. The next thing is to look at what we've got in barrel, see how it's progressing, decide if there's any kind of acid adjustments I have to make. Sometimes when your stuff finishes up at a really high pH, I'm not really a big fan of acidulating wines, but mm-hmm. at the same time, I don't want them to go just belly up. So,
yeah.
Once again, I'm working with some of the fruit I'm working with it's great fruit, but it's not perfect fruit. So as an experiment, I get to acidulate it, just see if I can make a good wine out of what would be questionable fruit.
Without going Frankenstein on it, I guess, too much, right?
What's that?
Without turning into like a Frankenstein experience.
Yeah, without Frankensteining. When you've had some people that have, you can tell when somebody has taken a perfectly good, somewhat flabby wine and tossed a bunch of acid in it. You can tell.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's probably tastes like drinking vitamin C. It's not great.
Yeah, it might I think one of my on the other side of that, my other peeve is the extremely extracted, the overly extracted stuff. I get the same sort of reaction, like, oh my God,
Yeah.
like, this is a
And
monster.
I have some of those barrels in cellar right now, the super extracted stuff, just because, here I am working with this very delicate, some awesome, nice, subtle, restrained fruit, Arizona fruit. And then so this fruit comes in from Paso Robles because I needed some color. So I was like, okay, I'll get a ton of something that has color just to bring in, a little bit of color. And of course, then I'm like in the mode of like trying to get some extraction out of some of these grapes from Arizona. I got this Petit Syrah in from Paso Robles, and oh my God, like everything you touch is stained. It's just, and I didn't have to make any effort. I just kind of got it in and got it going. And if I'd have treated this stuff the same way that I treated the other fruit, it'd be like ink. And I have some wines from those areas, and I go, oh my God, that's what those guys actually did. It's you can't even get near it. So yeah, I've
need
got
a hazmat suit.
Huh?
Need a hazmat suit.
Yeah, it's like I can see where I spit on the ground. It's like like smoke, and it's like alien blood eating its way through to China.
Hey, I got one last question for you, man. And appreciate very much the time. And I know the readers are really going to dig here in the interview. And I, in kind of prepping to talk to you, I was kind of canvassing some of the things that you and Eric Lomsky had already done in terms of promo and questions you've been asked. And, there's a ton of stuff that you guys have already done, right? And a lot of aspects of Arizona and your own personal projects that you've talked about. Through all that, is there anything that you haven't had a chance to describe about the project that you want to tell the world?
And of course I don't know if I've talked about it or not, but I think there's definitely, in Arizona we're finding that there's definitely some people that are trying to take shortcuts because it's a long and difficult road to get where we're going to end up at some point. And of course the people that aren't really into it for the right reasons, you would hope karmically that they would fall out. But there are definitely people that are, trying to, nudge around corners which is unfortunate. But I guess if anything we could talk about, which is something you can talk about any discipline in general, just as a broad sweep, just don't take the easy road. Just take the hard road. Like really dig in and study what the right path is. It'll be such a bigger payoff for you, just emotionally and spiritually and mentally. Just take the right path. Don't cut corners. And I think that's, of course it's the truth with any discipline, but I think that's one thing that I don't know that we've actually covered.
Very Tao of you, man. I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Hey, well, thanks so much for talking with me, man. Best of luck to everything you got going in the future. I'm really looking forward to seeing what you start pumping out in the next couple seasons.
Yeah, I think this year we're going to be planting a lot more in northern Arizona. One of the big things that we've just had a hard time with is northern Arizona is such a tourist and such an attractive area that the land is expensive. So trying to find water attached to relatively inexpensive land has been quite a challenge. And I think we've kind of tracked down a few spots that make sense that, and of course you can afford to do, and then of course then sit back for 5 years waiting for the grapes to catch up. But having done what we've done so far, I really think, you can go ahead and put this in a little time capsule and flash forward 10 years. I'm pretty confident that what you're going to see coming out of Arizona, depending on the sites, are going to be some pretty badass Italian style wines. I think the Sangioveses, Negramaros, just in general, Sangrentino, Alianico, I think you're going to see a lot of Italian style grapes coming out of Arizona that are pretty impressive.
Interesting. I love Negro Amaro, so that's awesome. It's awesome for me to hear.
I don't know who has it planted in. I don't know if anybody has it planted in southern Arizona, but I have an acre of it planted up. We planted it last year, or the beginning of this year, I should say. So, we'll be in our second leaf next year on that. And I just planted some Allionica, and I have the only. I think they just released, UC Davis just released some clean budwood for San Bernardino, but I managed to get. I think they just basically released a bunch of budwood to nurseries to start propagating it. But I happened to get 2 dozen pieces of the budwood, so I have 2 rows, like 24 pints of budded this past season. So next year I'll have like just enough San Bernardino to make like 2 gallons of wine off my vines.
Awesome. Well, looking forward to it. And one thing I appreciate too is that you've been so transparent in everything that you're doing. And from the blogging community, that's kind of something that comes, I guess, second nature to those of us who are doing the blogging thing. But it's in the wine world, it's definitely not second nature. So it's really cool to see that and get that insight. So, please, if I can make a request for what it's worth, please keep that up. That it's the stuff that I think as bloggers and the folks reading the blogs, we love to see. And it's great to follow along with the tragedy and the triumphs and really get that
Yeah,
insider view.
well, I think there's definitely going to be stuff that, along the way as a winemaker, you want to kind of keep some stuff close to the chest about how you handled some problems. But at the end of the day, even as much as you covet or you let go of, at the end of the day, if winemaking is remaining true to its form, you can't change the fact that this is this soil and this is this weather and this is this choice of grape you put on this soil. That's always going to be the constant. Like you can hide all your tricks and all your kitchen stylings, all you want. The grapes from that spot on the globe are going to be what really dictate what's in the bottle. So, I think I agree. Being transparent, if winemakers were a little more transparent, they would end up helping strengthen their area, especially the fledgling areas, to just navigate the local problems to get to the next level, which is a stable winemaking environment.
All right, man, we'll keep rocking that juice. And
All right,
thanks
man.
so much.
No problem.
Cheers.
Bye.